Good afternoon. I'm at the home of Mr. Carol Rivas in San Diego, California. Good afternoon, Mr. Rivas. This is a pleasure to be here. And what we're going to do is I would like for you to share your history about your involvement with the Montford Point Marines, but even before that, your life history. And I'm going to just let you do the talking. I will ask questions periodically, and then we can go from there. Does that sound like sound okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Could you try to lean over this way as much as you can? So looks closer to the camera. Okay.
First one is the easy question. What is your full name?
My full name is Carol Rivas.
And that's R-E-A-V-I-S?
Correct.
Where were you born and when?
I was born in 1923, May 11th, Brunswick County, Virginia, near the town of Lawrenceville, Virginia, county seat.
Okay, that's Brunswick?
Brunswick, yeah.
County. Briefly describe, we're going to talk about your involvement in the military, but I'd like to know what your life was before the war, particularly your education and the job you held.
I was born in a rural area, very rural. We call it country, mm-hmm. but it's real rural. I came out of a family of 16. I'm the fifth child of 16. Okay. I am the second oldest son, seven boys, mm-hmm. nine girls. I'm the second boy, the fifth child. Okay. We were raised on a farm. My grandmother's father inherited part of a plantation.
Okay.
And we was raised there. Growing up, we did not go to school as much as other people because of the distance and the availability of schooling. Mm-hmm. So I did go to grammar school in a town or in an area called Greentown, which covered all that whole section there.
Okay.
And that was a grammar school only. We only had one high school, which was 13 miles away in the town of Lawrenceville, Virginia. And very few people at that time get the chance to go there because of transportation.
Right.
Being in the country, so I didn't go to high school there.
Okay.
So I went to grammar school there, and then from there, by the time I was 15 years old, I was working full time on another farm.
What type of work were you doing?
Well, farming.
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 Okay.
Yeah, we would grow tobacco,
tobacco.
And stuff like that,
okay.
Cotton, and stuff like that, corn, and wheat, and syrup. Sugar cane.
Sugar cane, right.
Yeah, and...
did you have any poultry or any...
We had chickens and
okay.
cows and...
Just a regular farm.
Mules, and we had all the things. Only thing we didn't have was lambs and goats. We didn't have them. We
right.
just had cows and mules, okay. and a few people had horses.
Okay.
But I stayed there, and I worked on the farm, and then later, my first job was when I was 8 years old.
Oh, wow.
And I worked for my great uncle, who had got old, and he had all of his kids gone away, and my father sent me to stay with him and work for him, and he paid my father for me being there.
Oh.
A small amount, I guess $7-$8 a month probably, but he took care of me
right.
at 8, and I stayed there until I was about 9, so between 9 and 10, and worked with help him go to spring. We didn't have water running. We had to go to spring.
Right. Okay.
So
did your uncle have children?
My great uncle. This is my great uncle.
Great
my
uncle.
father's brother.
Oh, okay.
His children were. He was older, so
right.
all of his kids was gone, and they
right.
were. He was there. Had just him and his wife, and they couldn't get to the spring,
because mm-hmm.
spring was like you know, two or three blocks away down the hill. So I was sent there to bring water for them and help them like that.
Oh, okay.
So I did that between 8 and 9 years old, and by the time I was 10, I was moved. We had moved. Depression mm-hmm. came in when I was 7 years old, which a lot of people forgot about. The depression that came in 29.
Oh. Okay.
Well, that was the year my grandmother passed, and without education of anybody, Holly, in the family, the cost to bury my mother put the planted the land in debt that could not be paid because nobody had any money.
Right.
So a year or two later, maybe 2 years later, is when it was confiscated for the price for the per barrel.
Okay.
And that means we had to move. So here we are. My father then had all these children, right. But he had to move because the people wanted their money or whatever he had, and that was the land, everything. So they took it, and that we had to move to another place, which was a smaller house, smaller thing, and that made us sharecroppers then, see.
Okay. So you lived on the land, and for living on the land, you have to share the crop.
That's correct.
Okay.
But in the meantime, their income for the whole family was very small. So the older children, like myself and my brother and older sister, we was hired out to bring in income while my father farmed to feed, take care of the rest of the family, see.
And what kind of work did you do at that point?
Who, me?
I'm still working on a farm,
but I'm working on somebody else's farm, and they're paying my father for me working there.
Okay.
And by then, when I was 15, I was hired to another fellow who was one of the deacons in the church. He had a farm, and that was my father got, I think, $15 a month for me at that time. Mm-hmm. And then I was there with him until I was 16. And most people forgot, too, that the Civilian Conservation Corps started by President Roosevelt in 33 had organized and had juniors. There was four World War I veterans, but they organized it for junior, which young people, if you had a son of a certain age, you could get in there and make the same amount of money, which was $30 a month. Well, the $30 that I made, $25 had to go to my family. So that gave my family an uplift. They got $25 study a month from a government check every month, see, and I got $5 for health and comfort. So I stayed there, and I was in
where were you there? Where did you live at that point?
I was living in the camp. The Civilian Conservation Corps was a part of the Army Engineer Army Reserve, I would think. They used Army Engineer officers, reserve officers, to do the office we had. We wore Army uniforms, and I stayed there. That's where I was when the war broke out in 1941.
Okay.
I was in the CCC camp, and I stayed there until the war got going pretty good. Matter of fact, the Army came and they took a lot of us out of the CC camp right into the Army because we were already trained a little, see. So.
Right.
But there was a volunteer thing, and of course I didn't do it because I always said, well, I got a chance now to make some money, so I wouldn't go. Mm-hmm. So I left there when they disbanded it, and I went to work for the U.S. United States Navy at Yorktown, Virginia. A place called the Navy Mine Depot, filling bombs and warheads for torpedoes and stuff like that. And I worked there until I was drafted in 1942. I got drafted
in the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps.
That was the beginning of the Marine Corps. And they got drafted. When I got drafted, I thought I was going in the Army, but the Marine Corps was taking only volunteers. And they didn't get enough volunteers, so they started drafting, and I got caught in that draft.
Okay. And how old were you then at that point?
In 1942, I was 19 years old.
Okay.
But I was deferred for 1 year because I was working for the government. The Navy got me deferred for 1 year.
So you didn't have to attend training camp?
Well, I didn't have to go for a year.
Okay.
So in 1943, I had to report. And that's when I started.
Where did you report to?
I report to Montford Point. That's where that's where all Negroes had to report to Montford Point. They went in the Marine Corps at that time. There was a separation between the two. Mm-hmm. This country was had two races of people in it at that time, which people had forgot, I guess. They had Caucasian and Negro.
Uh-huh.
You were either one or the other. So we were Negroes, so we went to Montford Point. No matter where you came from, you went to Montford Point.
No matter where you came from,
if you were a Negro, you went to Montford Point for training. Well, Montford Point was part of Camp Lejeune, but it was this swamp, the southern part of this camp, near the village of, or the town, they call it, of Jacksonville, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And it was in this swamp where we didn't have barracks. We had huts, green huts, made out of cardboard that they used for bulletin boards. You could put thumbtack in them. And with the building, we helped build them ourselves. And mud and snakes, small bears, and everything was in that area there. People don't remember all that. They don't know about that. But we are telling about it now.
Exactly.
Because...
what was your day like? Just go through like a typical... Was there a typical day?
Well, you went through training there. They had We didn't have pavement like the other, like Paris Island and San Diego had. We had... We were on... All ours was on ground. Dirt. Mm-hmm. When the raining was mud.
Okay.
We trained on that type of ground. And we trained... packed down the whole field and made our own, everything was dirt. We didn't have any pavement at all. In 16 of us in those huts, we had potbelly stoves, they called it. It's a little round stove about this big, about this tall. And we got one...
Wood or coal? Was it heated by wood?
We got one scuttlebutt. I don't know if people now know what a scuttlebutt is, but a scuttlebutt was a coal bucket that got a chute on it to put it, and you put your dump for coal.
Oh, okay.
They call it the scuttlebutt. We got one of those each day at 6 o'clock in the evening. And that was all you got for heat. And that took your 16 people.
Scuttlebutt?
One bucket.
One bucket, okay.
There was one scuttlebutt per day.
And after that,
we ate in the mess. We had a regular mess hall. Mm-hmm. We had built... little tents. It started off with tents, and then they built a what we call a shotgun type thing, a straight building, you know.
Right. You can stand in the front and look all the way through the back.
There you go.
Okay.
So we had that, and that you got meals, but you were limited on the amount of food you could eat because there was no Marines didn't get fat. They didn't allow you to get. You couldn't gain no weight.
Okay.
You could wear certain sizes, and you get your when they issued uniforms. If you wore a size larger than at that time of for uniform, 6L was the largest blouse, which people call coat.
Right. You know,
if anyone needed something larger than that, they would be get put out the Marine Corps. You couldn't wear anything long because it'd be special.
Oh.
And so no fat people.
That's amazing.
When you ate what they gave you. You go through, you might get one piece of meat, might get two pieces of bread, you get one cup of milk, stuff like that. You were limited on the amount of food you could eat.
So the Marines in the barracks, they are in the little huts. They are the ones who prepared the food. They did everything.
Well, the Marine Corps, when they started, we didn't have anything but privates. Everybody was a private.
Okay.
We didn't have no non-commissioned officer or anything. All the non-commissioned officers we had were white. See, people who come in, they would ask them, well, what did you do? You know how to cook? Your mother teach you how to cook? They would put them in and let them cook until they could train some cooks, see?
Okay.
So all the training was done by the white people coming in at that time because we were the first black Marines. We didn't have no black Marines.
Right.
No officers, no anything. So later they had a steward branch and organized all the things that came along. They had to be trained. Everybody had to be trained for everything. That included cooking, supplies, communications. Everybody has to be trained because we had no people trained for anything. And we came up that way by there. And we
were you trained
8 weeks.
The exact way that all the other Marines, even though it was a segregated black unit,
boot camp. We went through, everybody went through boot camp.
Okay.
Every person went through boot camp. At the beginning, they brought in people who could cook and who could do things, administrative people. Mm-hmm. And they brought in white people.
And they were
people.
All white.
Yeah, all of them were white at the beginning. They had a staff of white.
Right.
Colonel Wood brought a staff in, and they stayed there until they could train enough Negroes to do the same job. We had no NCOs. And then we got six, the first six Negro drill instructors. You know, they were drill instructors. We have a coin out with the first six Negro drill instructors and the names and everything on it. But when you start brand new, you got to, someone has to start it.
Exactly.
And then you train the people as you go up. By the middle of 1943, we had started getting a few NCOs, corporals, sergeants, and things like that, and taking over from the white, that I'd say. And from there, we went on, they started with shipping people overseas. You get 6-8 weeks training. Mm-hmm. There you get a couple of weeks of combat training, maybe. But we wasn't allowed to go in combat. We couldn't do combat. We got 8 weeks, and we were shipped out.
And where did you ship to?
Well, they shipped them to the Pacific. Everybody went to the Pacific at that time. But the training, they started off to organize a battalion. They did organize a battalion, started with one, the 51st Defense Battalion. And then they had the 52nd Defense Battalion. But then they discovered that they need more people for supplies and stuff like that. And they started organizing ammunition companies and depots. Mm-hmm. So they had some 40-some depots and 12 or 13 ammunition companies before the war ended. But they all did supply work, carrying ammunition, depot handling equipment, and just supply generally. Mm-hmm. We did have the 51st and 52nd Defense Battalions who were the gun people. They had Sea Coast artillery, guns and things, but they went one place and stayed there during the whole war.
Okay. And how many times did you change duty stations?
During my prisoner miracle? Mm-hmm. I don't think I could remember all of that. I did 21 and a half years, so during that period, you get every 2 years after you get to a certain rank, you would be changed to different stations. And then depending on what your specialty were. And I...
What was your specialty?
Mine was 0369, which was infantry. But then we could carry more than one specialty, which I carried about four.
Oh, okay.
So I could go to investigator, I could be a infantryman, I could be supply man, I could be a lot of things because infantry carries all the different things. Mm-hmm. And I served at various naval stations. Philadelphia was one. I served in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And I went, that's different places you go to. You can't remember all of them, but couple of years I wound up as a drill instructor. I was a drill instructor over here at MCRD two years before I retired. I served in a rifle range. I was a rifle range coach for marksmanship instruction, teaching people how to shoot, training on gun, different tire size guns. So each gun got a different groups of guns, different sizes. You got the 30 caliber, the 50 caliber, the 40 millimeters.
Training.
You got the 105s. You got the 155s, all kinds of guns. Mm-hmm. So I trained on them too, see?
Okay.
So there's a lot of jobs that you do before doing your career in the Marine Corps, which I did a lot of it.
Were you involved in combat?
No.
Sir,
no.
If you could move your feet over towards, because you keep looking out the window and get the reflection.
Okay.
So if you just kind of face her more.
Well, I'm trying to look there. Yeah.
Should I move?
No.
No, you're fine. You should lean over this way just a little bit. There.
No, we were servants. So now, most of your depot company and ammunition companies, they carried ammunition to the front lines and bring your dead back. But they were not allowed to have ammunition.
Okay.
And the depot companies, they do the same thing, except they would handle all the equipment. It takes a lot of equipment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You got to have clothing, food, all kinds of stuff that to keep things in supply. Well, we were the ammunition group.
Okay.
That supplied the people online. When you get that lot of people, 30,000 people shooting all day long, it takes a lot of ammunition to supply them, and it takes somebody to supply that ammunition. But then you have to have somebody that knows something about ammunition because you get bad ammunition just like you do anything else. See?
Exactly. Okay.
And you can get a bad hand grenade or a bad shell. You fire it, but it don't go nowhere. It falls right in front of the gun and kill you. So you had to have this stuff inspected. So I became one of those inspectors, see,
right.
An ammunition company. So that's what I did during World War II. And mostly in Hawaii, I served most of my time in Hawaii inspecting ammunition and making sure that the stuff that was being used was usable and would do what it said will do, see.
Right.
Because the World War II, we used a lot of World War I ammunition. And we had to refuse all the artillery because they were using the same guns, but the fuses were different. Like we were hand grenades, they were 2 or 3 seconds or more, you know. So you, a person, 2 or 3 seconds is enough for the guy. You throw it at him, he throw it back at you. By the time we get back to you, you're dead.
Right.
See, so we had to refuse all that stuff, make sure it was done before we were issued.
So it's pretty dangerous position.
Well, that's terrible, but what are you going to do? Somebody had to do it, you know. Plus, we had to get rid of all the gas. We had gas, a lot of gas ammunition left from World War II, but it was still in stock. Mm-hmm. Ammunition people had to take care of that, get rid of it.
How did you do it? Just took it out?
No, we would take gas ammunition. We would take it one day to sea. We'd put it on a barge. We had to go out to sea for one day, travel all day, dump it, and then come back.
Oh, okay.
That's how we got rid of most of it, yeah.
Interesting.
So, especially your mustard gas and stuff like that was really leaking. A lot of it was leaking. And we used asbestos and stuff like that. Which we had a suit we had to wear when you're handling that. I mean, that's what we did, that kind of work. So, yeah.
Okay. So when you were in combat, were there...
I wasn't in combat.
You weren't in combat.
You were making sure that the people in combat got stuff that wouldn't kill them.
Right, okay.
You see, our job was to make sure they got the equipment was safe for them.
For the people
to
who
use,
were using.
Yeah.
Okay, I got you.
That including the weapons or whatever they was using, you got to make sure that they get it worked. Mm-hmm.
So when you returned home, let's go back to, were you married when you were in the military?
I got married after I went in the military.
After, okay.
Because I got married in 43, as young, 19 years old, 20 years old. I was 20 years old when I went into service. I got drafted at 19, but I got in when I was 20, and I married in that same year.
Okay. So what was the spouse's arrangement at that time?
The spouse arrangement, they stay wherever you left them. They couldn't go with you.
Okay.
They could not go with you at that time. They didn't have all the facilities that they have later. That the facilities came later where people could bring their wives and facilities for women. We didn't have facilities for women. We didn't have a lot of women in the service at that time.
Right.
Very few women was in the service. There was a few, but not very many. I don't think the Marine Corps had 1,000 and very few women was in the service at that time. Few was, you know, they were clerks and stuff like that. But
and you would see your spouse during when you would
well,
take
if you
leave.
Had a spouse, well, your spouse, she stayed wherever you put her. She stayed home mostly,
right?
Because you had no place to put them. You couldn't bring them to the base because the base had no housing for them.
Right.
So they had to stay with their parents or somebody with an apartment you rent them. But most people could not afford. And then at that time, too, you had to get permission to get married.
Oh.
If you wasn't a certain rank, you had to be at least an E4 sergeant, had to be at least a sergeant to get married, and then you still had to get permission to get married because there was no money for marriage. There was no money for the family.
Okay.
You had to live off of whatever you got.
Right.
And at that time, a sergeant was making like $72 a month total pay, and out of that they took I think it was $7 or something for insurance, and you know your other stuff that
medical and everything was included.
Well,
like
there was, everything was paid, but you still paid for insurance. Mm-hmm. Was the main thing, $10,000. Everybody had $10,000, but they took it out of your pay.
Okay.
And if you're getting $72, they take $7.20 for insurance. And then you have to take care of yourself. You have to take care of all of your supplies for to keep yourself up, like haircuts, shaving equipment, soap and stuff. Like you had to buy all that, see,
right,
out of your pay. And if you want to go and leave, I mean, well.
You had to buy that out of your pay?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You bought all that stuff. They give you the first issue when you first come in. Mm-hmm. After that, you buy everything. If you lose some of your clothes or tear some of your clothing or lose it, you got to mm-hmm. buy it. Otherwise, if you could keep it where you could survey it and get a new one, but you would sometime lose it, see?
Oh, okay.
I have this phone.
Go ahead.
Hello? Huh? Yeah. I'm kind of... Let me call you back. I'm kind of tired right now. Okay, buddy. It's my brother.
Oh, okay.
Calling from Lynchburg.
Lynchburg, yeah.
Everything like that you had to pay for, you know. If you lose your weapon.
So they issued you your initial uniform.
Original
uniform.
Yeah. Mm. And that could be replaced if you don't lose it, you know.
Okay.
A lot of people lose it. Someone might borrow it or might wash it, hanging on the line, and lose the wind blow or whatever.
Exactly.
But if it gets missing, you're required to have a certain amount of clothing. Like it's required to have 6 pair of socks, 6 sets of underwear, 2 sets of utilities, 2 sets of dress uniform, mm-hmm. 1 overcoat, you know.
Now, what are utilities?
Utilities is what people call dungarees.
Okay.
That you wear every day.
That's your everyday outfit.
Everyday outfit, you know, like.
Right.
We wear green,
or everyday
like
suit.
Overalls. Some people call them overalls, but okay. We call them utilities. You got to have at least 2 of those, mm-hmm. and have to be in good shape. You had to have a little pair of leggings, because in those days we didn't have boots; we wore leggings.
Oh, okay. And how? What
well, you had
leggings?
Canvas leggings.
Canvas.
Yeah, they were made out of canvas and laced up on the side. And when they get too white, like if they were out of draft, they get too light. You have to get rid of them and get another pair.
Mm.
See, but we wore leggings and your shoes. You had to have 2 pair of shoes.
Okay.
One has to be for dress and one for what you wear every day. And we had a field jacket, what they call a field jacket. That was a jacket that you could wear other than your regular, with your uniform.
Right.
Rather than. And then you had to have 1 rifle, you had to have 1 bayonet, you had to have 1 knife, you had to have a canteen, you had to have a cottage belt. You had to have a first aid kit,
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. You had
that's
yours.
Each person had those.
Each
things.
Person had that. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. 1 bayonet, 2. You had bayonet, 1 bayonet and 1 knife. You always that was part of the equipment.
When you were in service, how did you keep in touch with your family? Your
letters. You write a letter.
Okay.
You were required to write a letter every day.
Oh.
Every day.
Do you still have those letters?
No. I mailed them all.
Uh-huh.
But during the war, overseas, all your mail was censored. So I could write a letter to my wife or my mother, whoever.
Mm-hmm.
By the time they get it, more than half of it could have been cut out. Because some of the words would be used, they had to take them out. Because they may be part of a... Something.
Like secret...
That's right.
Okay.
So they were
so
censored.
You could only tell but so
you could
much
only
of what
tell,
was going
You could
on.
Never tell where you were. You never could tell anything like that. But you had to write every day. All mail was free.
Mm-hmm.
Mail was free. Cigarettes was free. Stuff like that. But
did everybody smoke?
I believe I don't know anybody that didn't smoke at that time, but
yeah.
We did have
light,
some.
Yeah.
We did have some people that didn't smoke, but that was very rare.
Mm-hmm.
The person didn't smoke. Everybody smoked.
And what kind of food did you have?
We had food, but canned food mostly. When you in infantry, they eat canned food mostly, mm-hmm. and the cooks would we had. Field cooks. You had regular cooks and field cooks. A field cook is a person that has to go out and set up and cook in the field,
mm-hmm.
Which was
over
rare.
Over the fire and
yeah,
and
whatever.
All the
well, you had right. We had stoves. You used something like a little tar pit, something we called burner, like mm-hmm. a camel. And they had field ranges. They could set up in the field and for a hot meal.
Right.
And you might get one hot meal a day, depending on how long you're going to be in the field and how many people are there. But most of the time, when you go to the field, you will issue enough rations to last you while you're in there. That means you get a meal for every... If you go into the field, say you go in the field for 3 days.
Okay.
Well, you have to carry 3 days ration in your backpack. That means you go get breakfast, dinner, and supper. That may be three cans.
Right.
Everything in one can, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then the next day you get that one. So you have to carry that for 3 days.
So you have at least 9 cans in your...
Yes.
At least for a 3 days.
Yeah. So you carry that with you. And then you get a little stack of thing that we, because I can't remember the name of it is now, but we could use that to cook. You light it like a candle and heat your food up.
Mm-hmm.
But this stuff is hard. Your biscuits was thin and hard. And you had stuff like beans, spam. Mm-hmm. They had simple stuff
right.
that you eat, but it was nourishing and
nourishing that would last.
Yeah,
that
and people yeah. survived off of it, you know. And then you get some fruit. You always had a little small can of fruit mm-hmm. with every meal. Maybe peaches, applesauce or something, you know, like that.
So what was the time frame that this is what you ate? Was it like for a year, for a month, some
well,
time?
Well, depending if you were in the infantry, you got infantry ate it like that. Longer you were in the field, the longer you were in infantry.
Right.
And once in a while, infantry comes in once in a while, what they call come into set up camp, and last 2 or 3 months or something like that, or come back for a rest. Then they go right back out.
Okay.
But
what was that time frame that you were in infantry? I don't know, like
everybody was infantry at one time.
Okay.
So okay. In the Marine Corps, everybody is infantry.
Okay.
It depends on whatever the situation is or whatever is needed at the time, or how many people they need for something. Because each organization has to have a certain amount of people.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, a company. In a company, you got companies, platoon, companies, battalion, regiments, divisions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a full first division, say that the whole division is moving. When you move a division, you're talking about 30,000 people plus people to support it. Well, now that's a lot of folk.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to have supplies for all these people, and each person needs the same thing. You're talking about uniform, you're talking about shoes, you're talking about weapons, you're talking about everything that a person needs.
Mm-hmm.
Tents, right. Enough tents. And tents wear out just like anything else. Of course, they canvas, right?
Right.
And when you go to the field, you got it's a great to move a group of people is very difficult, and to supply them and the people that has to supply them is kind of difficult mm-hmm. to do. But you have to have people that can do that and know how to do it.
And what did you do for entertainment?
There is no entertainment in the woods. Because people that entertain don't like to come out in the woods. It everywhere it's raining.
Right.
No facilities, no bathroom facilities. It's just, so once in a, you know, that's where USO people came
mm-hmm.
in. Then they would
right.
come to a nearby area that was safe, no shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And they would set up a place with a stage and everything and buses. And well, they didn't have bus trucks. Most mm-hmm. of them, the bus, you can use no bus out there. And they would put on shows and all bring the infantry in, and they'll set them in a semicircle around on the side of a hill or something, and they put on a show for them. That was the entertainment. The other entertainment was a movie,
mm-hmm.
a portable type movie that we could tour where some guy would set it up out in the field,
mm-hmm.
hook it up to a generator for electric, a few reels, and run that. Sometimes you had to run the same movie for a whole month until we get a new one.
Do you remember any of the movies? Are you joking me?
Do you mean the names of it?
Right.
No, not really.
Were they like,
we saw some of the same movies that people saw here, uh-huh. except they were shorter.
Oh, okay.
And they were, sometimes the thing would break down, you see part of it. Somebody,
but it was
that was the only entertainment you have.
Right.
Other entertainment was when we would organized what they call mural athletic, where platoon against platoon, you know.
Right. So you do sports like the football or basketball?
Basketball thing. Yeah. But you're doing it out in the field where you had to get your own, you had to make your whatever, your bat or whatever, you know.
And you can roll up leather for the ball and
whatever,
everything.
Whatever you can do is you have to provide yourself. See?
That's great.
Things are much different now than they were at that time because we were like World War One people at the beginning. Things changed as the war went along, and people invented different things for us. But we were more like the people of World War One at the beginning there. Right. But at the end, we were getting into the modern times. You know.
So you have an opportunity to go on leave?
You can only go.
Such a thing?
No, you don't get no leave when you're overseas. Where are you going to go? Yeah. I mean, you know, you're in a strange country there. You got to be careful.
Right.
You go overseas, everything is heishmuff, and you don't talk anymore. There's no place to. You can't let people go in town. I mean, you know, you turn loose a division in town, and they take over the town.
Right.
So, and then the people, wherever you were, there was combat and there was enemy. Mm-hmm. You're fighting the enemy. You're in the enemy territory. So any town you go to, the enemy is there. So you don't want your people out there. It's too hard to separate them.
Exactly.
And so there's no place to go in town. Sometime, depending on where you were, you could go back. If you had take the area and had secured the town or something, they might let some few people go back once in a while for a couple of days or something like that. European was a little different from the Pacific.
Uh-huh. In what way?
Well, the European had bigger cities, and there was land in the Pacific. It had islands, which were small villages and things like that. Japan wasn't as like it is today. Japan, the Americans built Japan up because Japan was very rural. Everything, the women walked behind the men, and a whole lot of stuff went on in Japan that didn't go, and Philippines were different. It was a whole different world, I mean.
Right.
At that time, things were very rural and dangerous, too, because the food and other stuff that you could eat over there or get, die from it. Many people died from just eating something one of the natives or the people, local people eat, but it kill you.
Okay, because your system, so you have
you had to be careful about what you allowed people to do. We had rules, but what you drank, what you eat, where you eat it. Mm-hmm. So most people ate only the military stuff because even
you knew what you were getting.
Yeah, but you couldn't allow people to do that, and you would instruct the people in that. Plus, all types of diseases available, and we once disease hit, it spreads through the whole organization, see. And that was the worst part of being in the military at that time, was to make sure somebody don't bring a disease into the camp. Mm-hmm. You could spoil a whole division, 30, 40,000 people in a few months, less than that.
Right.
If something get in. So this is what we had to watch out for. So this is why the officers and NCOs had to be very careful of the people they were over and teaching them to what to do and making sure that they did it. Because people out in the country, some kids never been away, never done this, never did. You really have to watch them because they'll get out there and...
Right.
And you know, see, men going to be men, and they see women, they don't care who the women are, where they come from, you know. They want to get involved, and you can't let them get involved, and that's a fight right there.
Uh-huh.
And you've got a 24-hour-a-day fight, but somebody has to have some control.
Right.
See?
Yeah.
And you put up perimeters around every area. We'd have a perimeter. And the perimeter, we set guards up around there, and these guards got instructors. No one passed you 24 hours. So everybody's surrounded with a guard. Now, I may be the guard today, tomorrow you may be the guard.
Right.
But if you violate, they're going to get you. If I violate, same thing. So,
what was the punishment? I know
punishment,
that meant you couldn't have had everybody do it, everything. Right?
No, but punishment during wartime could be anything, including death.
Mm.
See, commanding general or the area commander could order death. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they didn't have time for court-martials and stuff like that.
Right.
They have a short office hour or something like anything. And they had rules were different because they didn't have the Uniform Code of Military Justice then. See, that's a new thing came in after the war. Mm-hmm. That came in because of the things that took place during the war. The Uniform Military Justice included everybody, where we had, in the Navy, for instance, we had rocks and shores. The Army had articles of war. Mm-hmm. See, both the same, but one used, the Army used one and the Navy used the other. Mm-hmm. With rocks and shores, a person could get you for silent contempt. In other words, you could look at a person wrong way, mm-hmm. he can charge you with silent contempt, and that could cause you a lot of problems.
Like the old folks used to say, don't look at me like that, boy. Well, look at that,
well,
hey, girl.
The American Uniform Code of Military Justice cut out all that, see. But what the military Uniform Code of Military Justice brought in was what they call Article 34, which covered everything. That's the general article.
Okay.
And that was the most, that was the best thing could happen to the military, because it didn't just include enlisted men, it included officers too, see.
Okay.
See,
all right.
Before
so everybody
that,
was kind of held accountable
yeah.
at that point.
Prior to that, whatever an officer say was never disputed, okay?
Mm, okay.
Even though, say he don't like a person.
Right.
All he had to do is put a charge on him. It's going to stick, okay? Mm. He had no defense against it. You had no defense against it. So you had all kinds of things under the articles, what do you call rocks and shores, the Navy, rocks and shores, the Army, articles of war.
Rocks and Shores?
Rocks and Shores was the name of the law, what they call it. There was a, it was just, it's a book, mm-hmm. just like a law book, but that's what they call it, Rocks and Shores. And the Navy and the Army, they call it Articles of War. Same, with had the same rules, mm-hmm. just the Army used one. And they didn't have all the services they have now. You had the Army, Navy, Marine Corps. Actually, they had the Army and the Navy, because the Coast Guard becomes part of the Navy during wartime, see?
Right, okay.
Air Force, Army Air Force came under the Army. And then you had the Marine Corps. It was all, now we got all these other, we got four or five branches of the service now. Mm-hmm. You didn't have them then, see?
Oh.
It was difficult.
This question is, did you feel stressed? Of course you felt stressed. What were some of the ways you would deal with it, though?
Well, the thing of it is, when we talk about things like stress today, mm-hmm. those words was not used then.
I hear you.
See, there was no such a word as stress mm-hmm. used. A lot of these things came about since then. See? Mm-hmm. A lot of words that people use now was not used in those days. All these words that have come up new came from the war period.
Mm-hmm.
And wasn't no such thing as stress. I mean, you know, what do you mean by stress? You know, we
it
didn't
just wasn't
use that
even
word.
In the vocabulary.
It didn't, no, it wasn't in the vocabulary.
What would you, can you think of what would have, you know what it is now. So what would it equate to back in the day? What would have been the word that was used? Just.
Most people would say he's losing it.
Okay, okay.
Okay. In other words, he's going off, okay? So mm-hmm. people call it stress now. Say, so everything now is sick. Like a guy can be an alcoholic, he's sick.
Mm-hmm. You're right. You're right.
Well, they didn't do that in those days. He's a drunk, okay? That's
right.
All he is.
Right.
That's the word is he's sick. He's drunk.
So you know? Now it would be, it's so PC or politically correct. Then it's just you call it what it is.
We didn't have PC then. We mm-hmm. had marijuana, we had cocaine, and you know, stuff like that. But we didn't have all these things they have today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a guy, they didn't say he was a dope addict. He said he was an addict, period.
Okay.
And you wouldn't, and when certain things wasn't allowed in those days. Certain things you just couldn't do. There was no out. If you did it, there
you're
was
out.
No way out. You're out of it, period. You got caught with any type of dope, you out. I mean, that's the end of it. That's the end of your career. That's going to be the end going to follow you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Right.
Nowadays, they justify a lot of stuff, see?
No.
You're out of it. It's on your record and you're gone. Mm-hmm. Just like if you went to jail, for instance. If a person went to jail, that jail thing would follow him the rest of his life. You don't do that now. Person went to jail, nobody would hire him afterwards, for instance. You're jailbird. Stuff you know.
Right.
See, all kind of stuff that went on then does not happen today.
Mm.
It doesn't happen at all today. And then do the people that was doing it can't do it anymore. That's where the Uniform Code came.
Okay.
So the Uniform Code went online with the civilian. Things changed.
Okay. How do you feel about the, can you like describe a couple of the people that you remember, anybody that stood out while you were in your military time?
You mean stood out special?
Yeah, like some, you know, really good friends or something that happened with a buddy that I'll always remember that.
Like those three guys right there, two guys with me there.
Right.
I'll always remember them. We started together. The war ended.
Mm-hmm.
We went to boot camp together, went overseas together, served together, came back to the States together.
Oh.
All three are still living. All three from the same state. We were the boys from the Ville. Well, the boys from the Ville, I was from Lawrenceville, Danville, and Martinsville, all from the state of Virginia.
Mm-hmm. So okay. That was a connection.
We was all, and we was good buddies. I'd give my life for him. We were giving life for each other.
And the other two are still living?
Yes.
Okay.
Two of us become barbers and one became a dentist.
Mm-hmm.
The one sitting down became a dentist.
Okay.
He lives in Hinesville, Maryland. The other one lives in Bristol, Tennessee. And I live here.
Do you get together?
No, we haven't got together. Well, the thing of it is, they haven't joined or followed through because they didn't do 20 years. They did their time and got it right after the war.
Okay.
So the only time we keep in contact is like we have a convention every year, and we report on who's dead, who's alive.
Mm-hmm.
Like we had a convention here this year, the Mountford Point
so
Marine Association,
convention.
That convention, and we can report on people from every state.
Right.
Because there's somebody there from every state. And people know one another from the Montford Point area. Because we all went through the same camp, so everybody know who is who. May not know his name, but somebody mentioned he said, well, yeah, I know he's living, or he's dead, so you know.
Okay.
So every year we have roll call at our convention. When we open the convention, then the roll call go, and there's a silence and a prayer for those who have passed on each year. We lose 20, 30. This year, last year we lost 30-something.
Mm.
Since last year, we have lost, 42. June, we lost 42.
The convention is always in June?
No, convention was July.
July.
Convention time, yeah. But it's in different parts of the country. We had it here last year, this year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, next year it's going to be.
Did a lot of people come out? Those that could.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, most people now in wheelchairs, you know.
Right, right.
Everybody's above 85.
Yeah, yeah.
And so think where we go from 85 to a little better than 100. We got people 100 years old and 89, like guys like myself, see.
Mm-hmm.
They come in wheelchairs, the wives bring them, mm-hmm. daughters bring them. I know a couple of guys from New York, their daughter bring them every year. And Ohio,
and
Georgia.
Travel.
You bring them, you know, people. Everybody's old.
Yeah.
They're great-grandfathers and stuff like that, you know.
Well, tell us about the medal you received.
Well, there it is right there. See that? See the
oh,
one sitting up
it?
There? That's the medal, see.
And what is it called?
That's the Montfort Point Congressional Gold Medal.
Okay.
And we received that. That's a civilian medal.
Mm-hmm.
See, it's a Congressional Gold Medal.
Okay.
Given to civilians. That's the highest medal a civilian can receive in the United States.
Okay.
Although we were military people, we received that same medal. But what we received it for was what we did at Montford Point and what we did after the war during the year 46 through 48.
Okay.
And mostly in 46 and 47. And that was to not accept what took place before the war. We wouldn't accept the conditions, the way we were treated.
The segregated conditions.
The segregation, the barracks, the swamps, the stuff we would not receive after the war. Because, see, when the war ended, we was all the Negro Marines. When we came in, we didn't come in as regular Marines. We were all reserves, which we were in for the duration of the war and 6 months afterwards. We didn't get the 6 months. When the war ended and we hit the states back from overseas, we were discharged, automatically discharged.
Okay.
So a lot of us would not accept the discharge. We accepted the discharge, but then we went somewhere else and shipped over.
Okay. Did you join another service? Nope.
Some did, but most of us didn't. What happened was I was discharged here in California. I got on a train. I went from here to Baltimore and re-enlisted.
In the Marine Corps?
In the Marine Corps, because I was a sergeant, right? So I said, well, I done served during the war, and now they're kicking me out. There was nothing out. When the war ended, the jobs ended, see? Okay? So you'd have been out in the street. So we said, no, we fought the war, and now we want some of the goodies. So I could stay in and get paid like I would, like, you know, some of the good stuff.
Right.
And so I went to Baltimore, and I shipped over for 3 years. What did they do when I shipped me over? They sent me right back to Montford Point. Now, they could have sent me someplace else, but they sent me back where I started from. Well, now, I ain't going to accept this because I've been overseas and I've done what everybody did. Why should I go back to that when I know we got this over here nice?
Exactly.
Nice barracks, nice heat, steam heat, nice this, you know. Why would I go back to a scuttlebutt coal in a cold place and mud and stuff? Why would I?
Because so it was the same. The conditions were still the same in 3 years.
So we wouldn't accept that. So when I came back and reported back to Montford Point, it was only about two of us. And then in a few days, they kept tripling in from different parts of the country, see? People coming in.
Because the same thing had happened to them.
That's right. Well, we all was in the same boat.
Right.
So they were coming back, too. And what had happened, what they did was they would take rank from you. If you were a sergeant, they'd take your rank. They'd say, okay, you can come back in, but you're going to come back in as a PFC or a private.
So when you left and they kicked you out, you went to Baltimore.
And shipped over.
And you re-enlisted as a
sergeant.
Okay, so they didn't
take my rank.
Okay.
But later on, is what I'm saying, they started taking the guy's rank like a guy could have five stripes.
Okay.
They'd take two of them.
So in other words, they wanted to stop that.
But it didn't stop them. Didn't stop nobody. Yeah. See? So this went on through 46, 47, and it got so bad until the white Marines complaining, you know, because the country was segregated, right?
Right.
But we wouldn't accept that. So we almost become Marines against Marines. So they didn't want that. So Marines fighting Marines, see? Because we was fighting to live in the good barracks and to, because we had went through the war too. So it got so bad until the generals then went to Washington and everything. And in 48, Truman issued the executive order. I'm trying to think, it was 99 or something, I forget the number. But anyway, executive order, and integrated all the military services. So that when they integrated all the military services, they integrated the country. And this was in 1948. Although people did not recognize the reintegration of this country at that time, the recognition of the integration didn't come until 1961. But, of course, Martin Luther King was a little boy then, see?
Right.
All right? So when they started digging up the history of the Montford Point, the gold medal came about.
Right.
So when the commandant of the Marine Corps went to the Congress and said, look, these guys did this, 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 so the congressman voted 100% that we should be receive something for what we had went through and what we did and the treatment we had gotten and stuff like that. Because we were treated very bad, believe it or not.
I believe it.
We weren't going to take it anymore. So Congress voted us the Congressional Gold Medal because the Congressional Medal of Honor is for military mm-hmm. valor. The Congressional Gold Medal is for
civilian.
What a civilian do mm-hmm. in the same line of valor. So that's why we got the Congressional Gold Medal, and you're going to see more of the history, see the history. Even the World War II movies, you ain't going to see anything in the movie where black Marines was involved. You ain't going to see anything about them, but we were there.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the example of the example for the flag raising on Iwo Jima.
Mm-hmm.
We had people there. I had friends there. Well, the pole that they raised the flag on, a friend of mine's provided that pole. And you never heard of him.
And it was a black man that provided the pole.
Thomas McFadden, you might even know him. He got out of the Marine Corps after the war, went to John C. Smith University,
mm-hmm.
went through seminary, mm-hmm. became a chaplain. The Marine Corps don't have doctors and preachers. He being an ex-Marine, he got assigned to the Marine Corps as an officer, okay, and served as a chaplain. Rose to the rank of a full captain, Navy captain. Mm-hmm. Retired from the Navy as a full captain, but he's an ex-Marine, right?
Right.
He's the guy that did it. He died about 2.5 years ago, right here.
Mm.
But you never heard of him.
They just wrote us out of the history books.
Well, they didn't have any history. They got it now.
Right.
The Marine Corps has the finest museum in the country. If you want to know about this country, you go to the Marine Museum at Quantico, Virginia, mm-hmm. Triangular little town, and you'll find the history of this country from the beginning. From 1775, you'll find the Marines was involved in all everything. But there was no Negro Marines in there. Nothing.
But so it was just
we're talking
like
about 70. We talk about 70 years. What happened 70 years ago, and still going on?
Right.
People said it's been like this all the time. No, it hasn't. No, it hasn't. Because the Marine Corps existed in this country for 167 years without any Negroes in it. All of the services had Negroes. Except the Marine Corps. Yet, in 1776, we had Negro Marines in the Marines. Slaves who ran away and joined the Marine Corps in January 1776. The Marine Corps was founded in November 1775.
Mm.
Was it a couple of months different now?
Right.
But it wasn't called Marines. But they crossed the Delaware with George Washington and died at Princeton.
So they did the service.
In the service, but it was not called Marines, but we got names
mm-hmm.
from history books that they were Negro, they were slaves. Mm-hmm. But then they disbanded that when the Navy disbanded where the Continental Congress was at that time. They disbanded the Navy mm-hmm. completely, which the Marine Corps is part of.
Right.
Because Marines were served on board ships. But in 1886, somewhere in that area, that's when they decided to bring the Navy back. And they started by building six frigate ships,
mm-hmm.
which required Marines aboard.
Okay.
But this being a slave country, the Navy said, no, we can't have Negroes on the ship, slaves on the ship with the white people, see, because that's too close. So we're not going to have any. We don't want no Marines aboard. So the Marine Corps, part of the Navy, said, we won't have no Negro Marines, period. And that was in 1793, I believe it was,
mm-hmm.
when they said, we're not going to have any no more Negroes in the Marine Corps. We're not taking no more slaves. So there was no more Negroes in the Marine Corps from that time until 1942.
Wow.
160-some years. So in 1941... when the war was getting ready to begin in this country, they mm-hmm. knew the war was coming on because of German and stuff like that. The Marine Corps started building back up again.
Right.
And Mrs. Roosevelt jumped on her husband and said, look, we got to do something about this, all these Negroes in the service and everything. She said, what about the Marine Corps? The Army got Negroes. The Navy mm-hmm. got Negroes. What about the Marine Corps? How come they don't have any? Well, they didn't have any. They didn't want any, okay, because they've been 167 years with us. So we don't want any, see? So Roosevelt said, yeah, okay. So he signed the executive order. 8802 was the number.
Okay.
That he didn't said whether you had get black Marines or none. He said Fair Employment Act. It was the name of the act, see? Mm-hmm. The Fair Employment Act, which included the military. And when he included the military in that, that meant the gates was open now.
You gotta help
Negro Marines. But now this drives the Marine Corps crazy because they said, we're not equipped, we're not ready, we have nobody that can train them. We have nobody that know what to do with them. Let them serve in the Army. They can get this stuff in the mm-hmm. Army. So one of the people, the general said, well, I'd rather have, what he said, I'd rather have, if I had to have 500 Marines, I think he said was, he said, I'll take 200 white over 500, 5,000, something like that. Rather than have 500 black, give me 200 white and I'll take them because some kind of statement that he uh-huh. made like that, see. So there's a big fight over that. So finally they agreed, the Secretary of the Navy and they all agreed that they would take one battalion of 900 Negroes in the Marine, but they had to be volunteers because the Marine Corps was a volunteer organization. And when they passed after the executive order, they said, okay, we'll take them. But they only got 600 volunteer black people to join the Marine Corps.
Did the call go out? How did people know that, okay, now I can join the Marine Corps? It was an executive order, so it was, how was it?
It was the executive order that ordered the recruiters.
Okay.
The recruiters are in the streets. You see them.
Uh-huh. Right.
To start enlisting Negroes in the Marine Corps from 18, I think, to 28 was the age. Americans in there. That's how it got started when that order was issued, including the military. And then the Secretary of the Navy issued that order. They had to start recruiting them.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Navy had problems at that time. Only in the Navy, people could only be a steward, cook or something. That's the only way in the Navy. Well, when they do that, well, this kind of broke the Navy too, see? It followed through with the Navy. They started figuring them as seamen, regular field, because they could only certain other fields like gunners, mates, and stuff like that. Prior to that, they could only be a steward.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't wear what they call a crow on the sleeve.
Uh-huh.
When they get raided, they couldn't wear the crow, you know, the red stripe with the crow.
Exactly.
They wore what they called at that time loaves of bread, which was a little square white thing they wore for rank and stewards. They didn't wear the regular Navy uniform. They wore white uniforms. And that changed during that same time where they could get the crow.
But it became integrated.
Yeah. They could wear the crow and get the crow. That's what you mean. You go to second class, first mm-hmm. class. Prior to that, you were boy, 1, 2, 3, you know, look at that thing. All this stuff changed during that same time. See, but people don't talk about that kind of history.
Right. I mean, it's amazing. So you got out at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot here in San Diego. Where were you when your service ended there? That's when you got out?
I retired.
You retired in, okay. And you decided to stay out here?
Well, I served about 4 years altogether in Hawaii. 2 years after the war, I went there. Matter of fact, I served 50, 51. When I went from Philadelphia, I went to Hawaii. I was in Philadelphia for a long period of time right there.
Okay.
Near the Navy Yard and Fort Memphis for, I guess, 4 years. And then I went to Hawaii.
Okay.
Naval Ammunition Depot over there where they had the atomic bomb at that time. Mm. And I took over the security guard detachment that they had Marines at different bases there at that time, see. And I was a tech sergeant at that time, so I went over there as the guard chief, they call them, which is like the chief of police.
Mm-hmm.
And I served there for 2 years during the 50 years. That was during the Korean War.
Okay.
Then I came back to North Carolina, to Camp Lejeune, where I served as a military police in Wilmington.